Здравствуйте. Время новостей на Первом. О самых важных событиях расскажем.
Здравствуйте. Вас приветствует информационная служба телекомпании НТВ. В студии Дмитрий
Завод. Мы обсуждаем то, что важно знать в подробностях и к чему необходим компетентный комментарий.
Сегодня ее ведущие Лилия Гидеева.
Здравствуйте. В эфире «Прямая линия».
Сегодня в России Путин обсудил с постоянными
присоединился
членами.
И президент России.
Мы следим за развитием событий.
Это «Вести недели». Я Дмитрий Киселев. Добрый вечер. Смотрите сейчас.
War may be politics by other means. But Vladimir Putin also understands that politics can be war by other means. Having failed to achieve the destabilization of Ukraine on the battlefield, the Kremlin leader now appears to be trying to achieve that goal politically, by forcing the separatist-held parts of Donbas back into Ukraine with broad autonomy as a Trojan horse. Will Putin be able to achieve his goal of a Ukraine that is decentralized and federalized to the point of dysfunction? Or will the conflict in the Donbas end up being frozen? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is Alexander Motyl, a professor at Rutgers University Newark and author of numerous books on post-Soviet affairs. Welcome back, Alex.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. And also joining us from Washington, D.C. is Stephen Pfeiffer, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and the former United States ambassador to Ukraine. Welcome to the podcast, Steve. It's good to finally have you on.
Thanks, Brian. Glad to join you.
I'm glad you were able to. So how do you solve a problem like the Donbas? Everybody, or almost everybody, says the separatist-held areas of Donetsk and Luhansk Oblast should be reintegrated into Ukraine. But nobody agrees about what this means. Ukraine wants them reintegrated with the same status as any other region in the country and with the separatists disarmed. Russia wants them reintegrated as a quasi-autonomous entity, something like Republika Srpska in Bosnia-Herzegovina, and with pro-Moscow rebels legalized as the legitimate rulers. And given the political realities, everybody, or almost everybody, thinks that in the end, this conflict will end up frozen. Steve, where are we now, and where do you see this going?
Well, I can see three possible scenarios. One scenario, which I think is very unlikely, almost a zero probability, is that peace breaks out and by December 31st, all of the terms of the Minsk II ceasefire arrangements are implemented. But you, particularly on the side of the separatists of the Russians, have seen no effort to do that. The second scenario, which I think is more likely than peace breaking out, but I still think is not that likely, is a resumption of full-scale hostilities. I don't think that that is likely because, first of all, the Ukrainians have no interest in that. They know they can't beat the Russian army. And on the Russian and the separatist side, I think Moscow understands that a major offensive undoubtedly leads to more Russian casualties, which they wish to avoid at home. It likely leads to additional sanctions from the United States and Europe. And to the extent that they move beyond the current line of contact, they're going to be entering territory that is very hostile to Russia, and they're going to increase the chances of encountering a guerrilla conflict. So unfortunately, I think the most likely conflict, or the most likely outcome, the most likely scenario, is something like you've seen over the last several months, a frozen or a not-so-frozen conflict, where no huge fighting, but you still have shelling every day, where discussions continue in the trilateral contact group, but no real progress towards a settlement. And unfortunately, this could be the static situation for a number of months.
And then what? Because there are frozen conflicts and there are frozen conflicts. With the frozen conflict in Abkhazia has lasted a couple of decades now, more. The frozen conflict in South Ossetia, the same, Transnistria, Nagorno-Karabakh, to pull it into an even other area. Do you see this turning into that kind of scenario?
Well, there is this possibility, and it gets down to Russian motives. And there's a very distinct difference between how the Russians look at Crimea, which I believe the Kremlin plans on holding on to forever if it can. But they have not made a similar move to try to incorporate the Donbas. And it looks like over the last 18 months, what the Russians have seen the conflict in eastern Ukraine as, it's a mechanism to distract, to destabilize the government in Kyiv, and to make it much more difficult for President Poroshenko and Prime Minister Yatsenyuk and their government to implement the very necessary economic and political reforms and to implement the association agreement and draw closer to the European Union. So they can ratchet pressure up or ratchet it down as they need to in eastern Ukraine to cause problems for the government in Kyiv.
Yet, I mean, my feeling has always been that their goal was to create Bosnia in Ukraine, essentially, to reintegrate the separatist held areas so they would be something akin to Republika Srpska in Bosnia Herzegovina. Like I said, that's their maximum plan. And this is why all these calls for autonomy and federalization are going on. This is why the push to get this autonomous status into the Ukrainian constitution, which was in the news recently, with the first step of that passing its first reading in the Ukrainian parliament. But Poroshenko's wise. Everybody's wise to this. And yeah. I'm certain Poroshenko's wise to it. Ukraine's not going to let that happen. So that leaves us in this deadlock, this stalemate. You think the frozen conflict would suit Moscow as a vehicle? Because it wouldn't be able to destabilize Ukraine the way they had been hoping to, which is basically turning it into Bosnia.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you're right in that the ideal Russian goal is to create... is to basically see the reintegration of the occupied parts of eastern Ukraine back into Ukraine, but under the terms that Moscow would like, which would basically allow regional authorities and Donetsk and Luhansk the ability to veto national legislation, to veto foreign policy decisions, to veto national defense decisions. I mean, we haven't seen exactly what the Russians have in mind for Donetsk and Luhansk because they've never spelled it out. But I think if you go back to 2003 and look at the Kozak memorandum that the Russians proposed for reintegrating Transnistria into Moldova, and when you looked at the Kozak memorandum's terms, it would have made Moldova just unworkable. The state wouldn't have functioned if Transnistria disagreed with policy decisions in Chisinau. And I believe the Russians have something that like that in mind. And it's understandable, very understandable, why the government of Kyiv says, no, we don't want that. From what Poroshenko has said, there does appear to be a willingness to do some decentralization, which actually makes sense. I mean, yeah. Ukraine has too much authority concentrated in Kyiv. Pushing up power and authority down to the regional and the municipal levels, it makes sense in terms of more effective, more efficient, more accountable governance. But the national decisions on defense and foreign policy, things like that, need to stay in Kyiv. And that's the gap between what the Russians want for the area and what the Ukrainians are prepared to accept.
And we're also talking about devolving power to authorities who are legitimately elected in free and fair elections, not at the end of a barrel of a gun, right?
Exactly. And I think that's a key demand and an understandable demand by Ukraine is there needs to be a free and fair election, which in the current circumstances is going to be very hard to do. You would have to have a massive presence by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe to monitor not only the election, but the election run-up. But I think the authorities in Kyiv have said whoever emerges from that election, they would then be prepared to have a conversation with.
Mm-hmm. Alex, you've been writing a lot about this. I've been reading a lot about what you've been writing on there. What are your thoughts? Where do you see this going now? Steve laid out three scenarios, the frozen conflict being the most likely. What do you see?
Well, I generally agree with everything that the two of you have been talking about. There is a kind of Alice in Wonderland quality to a lot of these current discussions about federalization, special status, elections, and the rest. The sides have such radically different positions and what they mean by that, that in essence, the discussions are simply a way of kicking the can down the road, avoiding making decisions and pretending that one is committed to a process that everybody pretty much agrees, at least privately, is unlikely to lead to any long or even medium or even short-term solutions. That said, I do think, however, that freezing the conflict, Steve used the word unfortunately, which implies that that's a bad solution for Ukraine. I actually happen to think that's one of the better solutions for Ukraine. Freezing the conflict is actually bad for the Russians. And the reason for that is that the Donbass enclave that's currently occupied by Russian and separatist troops is an economic mess. The GDP fell something like 86% last year. And the decline is continuing, investment is unlikely to take place, and the degree to which one can sustain that kind of entity in the medium to long term is decidedly dubious. I mean, it's in Ukraine's advantage to keep that out of its control for as long as possible, for as much as possible. And it's certainly to Russia's disadvantage to have to be responsible for that. Now, at present, they're saying, yes, they want Ukraine to take it over, and it's not their responsibility, there are no Russians there, and so on and so forth. But, of course, the bottom line is that Russia is responsible. I mean, it's the one that's been sending the so-called humanitarian convoys. It's the one that is ultimately going to have to bear the brunt of the continued economic collapse. I mean, if there is social unrest, and that is not inconceivable, even given the relative passivity of the Donbas enclave population, then that is going to be a problem, not for Ukraine. That's going to be a problem for the separatists and the Russians.
Alex, I know you made that argument, that very provocative argument in the past, that this would be the best thing for Ukraine. Do you think that's in fact what Poroshenko is doing without saying he's doing it?
I don't think Poroshenko necessarily wants to say or intends to say something along the lines of that Ukraine will officially give up these territories.
Never.
And so on. And he can't, and I'm not sure he should. But I do think, I mean, from what I, you know, when one tries to read in between the lines, statements by him, or especially by his right-hand man, Yuri Lutsenko, one gets the sense, or at least I get the sense, that they're fully aware that, A, Ukraine has no chance in hell of reintegrating these territories anytime soon, either militarily or non-militarily. B, they seem to be fully understanding of the fact that this is an economic hellhole that is going to drag down the Ukrainian economy, as well as prevent integration into the West and all those other sorts of things. And that the best possible solution is simply to delay making any kind of solution for the medium to possibly even long term. I believe it was Poroshenko or possibly Lutsenko, I forget which, who recently said or said on a number of occasions that the best way for Ukraine to reintegrate the territories is to become a successful state that will then serve as a force of magnetism or something to that effect for the populations of these territories. Well, that's another way of saying, hey, we're not going to make any decisions about this for many years, because it will certainly take Ukraine at least 10 to 15 years to become a successful state. And of course, it also means that at that point, if and when we are successful, we'll simply see what they, that is to say the population of the Donbas enclave, happens to think about our success story. Well, if they think it's wonderful, then they'll rejoin us, but they may simply decide that they don't care, in which case, c'est la vie, arrivederci, go off on your own.
Steve, what about that on both points? A, is this in the best interest of Ukraine to simply, whether you say it this way or not, let go of these territories? And B, do you think that is what President Poroshenko is indeed doing, although not saying he's doing?
Yeah. Well, I mean, first, it's unfortunate, the frozen conflict, in the sense that this remains a festering sore. It means that the problem doesn't get resolved. And it is unfortunate for those people who are trapped in the Donbas, because I think it's pretty clear, A, that the Ukrainian government doesn't have the resources to provide much help, and B, that the Russians are only going to provide enough to sort of keep people from starving. So I think the people in Donbas are going to find that their situation in the coming months is going to be pretty meager. And I guess I would agree with Alex, if giving up the Donbas would solve the problem, you know, I think that would be a smart strategy for Ukraine. But I don't think it solves the problem because, again, I don't think the Russians are after the Donbas per se. They're looking for a means to put pressure on Poroshenko and Yatsenyuk and their government and to make it more difficult for them. And I was surprised, I guess, when I was there already actually last September, how many people in Kyiv, including some senior officials, privately would say, maybe it is time to give up the Donbas. They don't think like this and such. So at the end of the day, you know, maybe there is that readiness. Now, they also said it was too early, and this was, of course, September of 2014, for any serious politician to say that publicly. But at some point, Ukraine might well reconcile itself to losing that part of the Donbass that's been occupied by the Russians and the separatists. But again, I'm not sure that solves the problem, because Moscow is not after territory there per se. Moscow's looking at ways to make life difficult for Kyiv.
Yeah, and actually, I've often thought, one of the best ways that Poroshenko could wrongfoot Putin would be to go in front of the UN and say, look, these territories are ungovernable. We cannot govern them. We don't want to fight for them. And we are giving them up. Now, that, of course, that's never going to happen. But that would be Putin's worst nightmare. Would it not?
I think that's right. But I think you're right. You know, politically, that's probably very difficult for Poroshenko to do. But yes, certainly that would not be a welcome step on the Russian side. The Russians would, I think, back away from that. Because, again, the Russians recognize that first in that area, well, there are some modernized industries. There's also a lot of Rust Belt dinosaur industries. And second, the military conflict of the last 18 months has inflicted significant damage both on industry and infrastructure. The Russians were unpleasantly surprised by how much it cost to support Crimea, and particularly at a time when their economy is contracting, they're under sanctions from the West, and the price of oil appears to is going to remain soft for some months to come, they would not be eager to take on the economic burden that occupied Donbass would pose.
Yeah, no, it's a bit of a perfect storm, given how this is impossible for Poroshenko politically, as outlined by some poll numbers I saw in the last couple of weeks. Large majorities of Ukrainians are opposed to giving the separatist-held areas of Donetsk and Luhansk Oblast the broad autonomy that's in the Minsk agreement. They just don't want the large majorities are against this because they know what this is all about and what this is going to end up doing. But they're also opposed to giving up these territories, and it's kind of an impossible situation for Poroshenko this way.
To the extent that he feels trapped by those poll numbers, there's a box that's going to be very, very hard to get out of. Now, again, on the autonomy question, this is one of the things that I think actually the government in Kyiv could help itself by, is by coming out and defining exactly what sorts of autonomy it's prepared to give the regional and municipal authorities.
Across the board, you mean?
Sorry?
Across the board, you mean, yeah?
Across the board, yeah, or across the board. Because the situation that you have now is there's this stale debate where Ukraine says decentralization, Russia says federalization.
Right.
Federalization is not necessarily a bad term in the United States, a federal republic, or in the Federal Republic of Germany, or in the Polish Republic. But again, if the Ukrainians were to describe what they have in mind, and I've heard some Ukrainian officials say they would push things like down to the region's authority on health issues, on education issues, that actually sounds, most would say, well, that's kind of federal, that's an acceptable kind of federalization.
Right.
And there would not be an expectation that Ukraine would cede to regional authorities veto power over foreign policy or defense policy. And I think to some extent in Kyiv, they're not as in a stronger position as they could be because they haven't articulated exactly what those powers would be, which I think would, in fact, stream to many people as perfectly reasonable.
Mm. There's another issue, too, is the issue, and that's why I asked, you mean across the board, because there's the issue of some kind of special status for Donetsk and Luhansk, or the rebel-held areas of Donetsk and Luhansk. And this is what really sticks in the throats of Ukrainians and other regions, because people in Lviv are saying, well, wait, then why don't we get this too? And that's exactly what Russia's hoping for, to, again, like I said, decentralize it to the point of dysfunction.
But again, I mean, even before the situation developed in eastern Ukraine, I mean, when I was there at the end of the 90s, we were telling the Ukrainians to decentralize. You have too much power in Kyiv. It makes more sense to give governors more authority, make them accountable either to local councils or make them have them chosen by direct elections. You know, push authority down. That makes sense in terms of a more efficient and accountable way of running the government. Now, Ukraine ought to do that across the board. If they want to give a couple of smaller things also to the Donbass so they can say, well, that's your special status, that's perfectly fine. I mean, but national policy, foreign defense policy should appropriately stay in Kyiv. Mm-hmm.
Alex, anything to add here?
Well, I think the important point to keep in mind is that Ukraine actually has legislation on decentralization. And just yesterday, as a matter of fact, the Constitutional Court reviewed that legislation and approved it. And of course, it's a rubber stamp institution. But that being said, it's an important it was an important hoop through which the legislation had to pass. And it's the legislation exists, and it pretty much accords with what you and Steve have just been talking about. They're foreseeing a significant decentralization of authority regarding issues of health, culture, regional development, things like infrastructure and the rest. There's talk of consolidating villages so as to have fewer numbers of districts, fewer numbers of autonomous regions, have a certain degree of consolidation, which is supposed to be voluntary. There's talk about direct and all sorts of other kinds of elections. The legislation foresees the creation, the abolition of the position of governor and the creation of a position of a prefect who would supposedly supervise the constitutionality of the goings-on within any mm-hmm. particular region. So, as I said, the Constitutional Court has approved this, and that means that presumably this kind of legislation will be open to, well, will be approved by the Rada sometime in the immediate future.
In the fall is what it's looking like. That one line in the constitutional amendments, and we're going to talk more about this in the second half, but that one line saying that the future status of Donetsk and Luhansk will be established by a special law, which really stuck in the throats of a lot of people, but yet which the U.S. lobbied heavily for. But yeah, that law's got to pass, get a two-thirds majority because it's a constitutional amendment, and then there's going to be another debate about another law about the status of Donetsk and Luhansk. The irony of all of this, of course, is that Russia on paper is supposed to be a federal state, and it's anything but. And Ukraine on paper is a unitary state. Turning to Russia, there's been some interesting things I've picked up on in the last couple of weeks. Just this week, Ihor Plotinsky, the self-styled head of the Luhansk People's Republic, said that he and other separatist leaders are in negotiations with Moscow to get passports issued to the residents of the rebel-held areas. This comes at a time when I've seen more material appearing in the media. An article in Voyennoe Obozrenie is arguing that the rebel-held areas should be turned into, quote, a second Belarus. That is a authoritarian state that's completely dependent on Russia. There was an article in Izvestia last week that argued that Russia should just outright annex these territories. It seems to me the debate is changing a little bit in Moscow now, and there's talk of grabbing what they could get right now. Steve, do you see that? Is this desperation shifting to Plan B, smoke and mirrors? What do you make of all of that?
Well, I think you see now a bit of discussion, but again, it seems to me that were Russia to move to annex, there are substantial costs for Russia. I mean, if Russia annexes, Russia then has economic ownership. They can't avoid that, so it's going to be a new drain on the Russian budget. Second, that kind of step, moves in a degree of irreversibility and would almost automatically, even in Europe, trigger additional sanctions mm-hmm. on Russia. So I don't exclude that the Russians may be thinking about that, but it does have some real prices. And the Russians, again, seem to be treating Crimea differently mm-hmm. from the Donbass as they've downsized over the past year their expectations. Vladimir Putin hasn't mentioned the word Novorossiya in public, I mm-hmm. think, now in about 10 months, which I believe reflects his understanding that there's not a lot of enthusiasm in much of the rest of Ukraine that hasn't been occupied for inviting the Russians in.
Yeah, no, I mean, I saw if he could have seized all of that, and we're talking, you know, from Kharkiv to Odessa, which, as you said, would be very hostile territory at this point. If he could have got all of that, he would have wanted it. What he got is the worst part of that chunk, and he wants no part of it now. But short of annexation, what about the option of a kind of a statelet, a protectorate that Moscow would recognize that would be similar to Abkhazia, South Ossetia, Transnistria, that would be the second Belarus option? And this, I wouldn't take this seriously, except I see these things popping up in places like Vyenne, Abazarenia, and Izvestia, where serious policy, well, serious and non-serious policy ideas tend to be floated. But when it starts to be floated in publications like that, I begin to think people in the Kremlin are seriously thinking about that. So maybe annexation, you're right, carries serious costs. What about a protectorate?
Again, that would seem to me to just moving in the direction of another frozen. It's a different variety of frozen conflict. Mm-hmm. Becomes something like Transnistria or South Ossetia. And again, that is where it looks like the situation in eastern Ukraine is headed for.
Mm. Alex, your thoughts?
Well, you know, we keep on talking about, I mean, I'm glad you raised Russia, because we keep on talking about Ukraine and its choices within the Donbass. But the bottom line is, I think that Russia really has no good options in the Donbass. I mean, that is in some ways the key. And that has a lot to do with the fact that at least at this point in time, and certainly for the foreseeable future, it is the owner of the region. And whoever owns the region, whoever owns the territory, is the loser. I mean, you know, it's not exactly owning Switzerland. You're owning a hellhole. So the question for Russia is, how do you get out of this? Well, we talked about one possibility, which would be some kind of major war. But as Steve rightly said, I mean, the costs associated with that are extremely high. The risks are extremely high. And of course, last but not least, we've got to remember the Ukrainian army today is no longer what the Ukrainian army was a year and a half ago. I mean, the Ukrainians would put up a very tough fight, and it would be a very, very bloody, protracted, and complicated affair. So let's assume that's unlikely. Not impossible, but say unlikely. Well, then that leaves status quo, which isn't much of a solution to anything, because Russia still owns the place, and the economic decline will simply continue. They could annex the territories. That would in some ways be the worst possible solution for Russia and the best possible solution for Ukraine, at least from my perspective. Or create something like a protectorate, which again is either an equivalent of a freezing or a progressive transformation of the region.
It's a soft annexation is essentially
how I mean. Soft annexation is what it comes down to, right. None of those really work for Russia. It's stuck with a region that is a hellhole and is likely to remain one for the foreseeable future. It also leads to sanctions. It also leads to all sorts of difficulties and so on. I mean, I should say every single one of those regions is options is essentially a non-starter. Comparatively speaking, the one that is least costly is essentially the status quo. Mm-hmm. Just kind of maintain things as they are, engage in a little bit of fighting, not too much, not too little. That, of course, keeps the Ukrainians on edge, but that doesn't prevent Ukraine from moving in a Western direction. That doesn't prevent Ukraine from adopting reforms. I mean, we keep on saying Ukraine hasn't done enough, and that may be true, but it's done quite a lot, despite the fact that there's been a war, or perhaps because of the fact that there's been a war and an existential threat to it. So in that sense, I mean, I'm going to suggest to you that Ukraine is almost inevitably going to be a winner of some kind as long as it can keep its hands off the Donbas enclave. And Russia inevitably is something like a loser as long as it continues to have the Donbas enclave in its possession in some form or other. And mind you, Ukraine can't be forced to accept the territory other than a takeover and a military occupation. It can be coaxed, it can be persuaded, but it can't be forced to do so. I mean, Russia would literally have to march into Kiev in order to force it to do so. And that seems unlikely, at least according to one of the scenarios we talked about.
Well, that's an excellent way to segue into the second half. So in a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at how the West is approaching the diplomatic endgame in Donbas and address speculation that the U.S. and the EU may have cut a deal with Russia at Ukraine's expense. I would like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is Alexander Motiel, a professor at Rutgers University, Newark, and author of numerous books on post-Soviet affairs. And joining us from Washington, D.C. is Stephen Pfeiffer, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and the former United States ambassador to Ukraine. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFERL.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Well, there is zero linkage between our policy in Iran and our policy in Ukraine. Russia acted in its own self-interest to cooperate with us in striking a very important agreement on the Iran matter. In Ukraine, we continue to have profound differences over Russia's continued violation of Ukraine's territorial integrity. And under no circumstances are we going to dilute those concerns in furtherance of some unrelated policy issue.
Well, that was the man that used to sit in your old, that now sits in your old office, Steve. That, of course, was Jeffrey Piatt, the current U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, addressing speculation that's been rampant in recent weeks that the United States may have sold out Ukraine to Russia to get the Iran deal. Steve, you've no doubt come across some of this. Andrei Illarionov has been writing about it, as have others. There's a lot of rumblings in Kyiv about it. I've addressed all this on my blog. Whether or not there was a deal, and I highly doubt there was, I don't think these things actually work that way. It is true that the West has been pushing Ukraine to fulfill the political aspects of Minsk II, the federalization, the autonomy for Donetsk and Luhansk, before Moscow fulfills its military obligations and the separatists fulfill their military obligations of ceasing hostilities and pulling back heavy weapons. Steve, how do you see the West's strategy here in this? Because these suspicions came up for a reason. I mean, people were suspicious for a lot of reasons, most notably because Victoria Nuland traveled to Kyiv on the day the amendments to the Constitution that noted the autonomy for Donetsk and Luhansk were passed. What's the West's game here, and what's the U.S.'s game?
Yeah. Well, first, let me just I'm pretty sure that what Ambassador Piatt said about no link is entirely correct. Russia, in the end, supported the P5+1 outcome with Iran because, A, Russia did not want to see Iran with a nuclear weapon, and, B, Russia did not want to be the outlier who caused the whole agreement to crash. I mean, in particular, that would have put them very crossways with the Chinese who want to see this agreement going through. So, historically, the U.S. and Russia are both very good about compartmentalizing. They can agree on issues where they disagree on others. When I served at Embassy Moscow back in the late 1980s, we did the Treaty on Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces. We almost got the START 1 treaty finished. There was progress on human rights, and every month we were pumping stingers and money into Afghanistan for use against the Soviet military there. So we know that the countries know how to compartmentalize. What's behind, I think, the Western push here, and I see this as making sure that 5 months from now, when you hit December 31, and everyone looks, I mean, that's the date when all of Minsk II's supposed to be implemented. When you look at the scorecard, it's going to be very much in Kyiv's interest that Ukraine can say, we did everything, even though the military arrangements were not observed by this side. We went ahead and tried to make the political points of the agreement happen. Because what Kyiv wants to have happen on December 31st is that the West looks at this agreement and says, the reason this has not been fulfilled is because of a failure in Moscow and a failure on the part of the separatists. So to the extent that Ukraine is seen as doing everything it can to make the agreement real, it then creates a situation where when the agreement is seen by everyone, including the two primary Western authors, or at least the two primary participants in Minsk II, Chancellor Merkel and President Hollande, when it's seen as having not succeeded, they want the blame to be on the Russians and the separatists.
No, I tend to agree with you, although I see why a lot of people in Ukraine are nervous about this. I mean, though, yeah. That one sentence that Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Nuland got lobbied for, according to the reports I've read, and that got into that those amendments that passed the RADA on the 16th of July. That rankled, the people were so upset about that because for the first time in the Ukrainian Constitution, if this gets the 2/3 majority necessary to pass in its final reading, it'll be in the Constitution that these territories, these separatist held territories, are special and have special status. And that drives people crazy. And this is what started to fuel all of this. When you step back and look at it, it doesn't mean anything. All it says is that a law will be passed that will determine the status of these two regions, and that law won't even be debated until the autumn. But there, do you see any risk here? And I agree with you. The U.S. and the Europeans are trying to get to make sure Ukraine has ticked off every box, and so the finger can be pointed at Russia. But is there a risk of this? Are these fears legitimate about getting these kinds of things like this into the Constitution?
I think you made the right point. Is, you know, it's one sentence. You know what that means. I mean, that will be up to the Ukrainians and the Ukrainian Rada to decide. And again, what I would hope you see is broad decentralization across the board, and maybe a couple of points that give something extra relatively small to the occupied part of Donbas, but again, maintaining national policy in Kyiv. Mm. So I think this is eminently workable. Mm. But again, if Ukraine is doing it, Ukraine is going to be able to position itself so it can say, we tried to make this agreement work, even though it had lots of complexities, and even though the other side wasn't willing, we made every effort. The reason it did not succeed is because of the Russians and the separatists. Mm-hmm.
Alexander, will you agree?
Well, the sentence that you referred to, I mean, does a very nice job of splitting hairs or splitting
I'll
the difference,
say.
If you are. because it doesn't talk about special status. It simply kicks the can down the road, as it were, by stating, that the status of the territories, I mean, it's even a little more vague than that, will be determined by legislation. Well, fine, fair enough. But at this point in time, the legislation sort of exists, doesn't quite yet exist. And of course, the legislation will, in fact, then be determined by the RADA in cooperation with the president and the prime minister and so on and so forth. That's perfectly fine. I mean, there's nothing there that suggests that the Donbas is special. All it says is that there will be certain kinds of legislation. That, by the way, happens to be consistent with Minsk II, which says quite specifically that Ukraine is supposed to adopt permanent legislation on the special status of certain areas of the region.
Right.
So it's legislation. It's not a constitutional change. Putin and the separatists have been insisting on constitutional change regarding special status, but that's actually not in Minsk II. So the Ukrainians, in this sense, have actually been quite consistent with Minsk, and in addition to that, have been consistent with their own constitutional preferences. I think what ticked many people off, obviously, was that, but in addition to that, it was Victoria Nuland's somewhat obvious presence in the RADA, and her coming and instructing the RADA on what to do.
And bad optics, you mean?
Pardon?
Bad optics, simply.
It was the bad optics, yes. And there was that sense then of wounded sovereignty, wounded pride. After all, we Ukrainians are a sovereign nation. And as much as we like the Americans, I mean, they shouldn't quite be doing this quite this openly, quite this obviously. And I suspect there's something to that. It may not have been necessary for Ms. Nuland to have been in the RADA. It might have been perfectly sufficient for her to come to Kyiv, meet with the appropriate individuals, and get the point across that it's important to the United States that some kind of legislation, some kind of changes be adopted that put Ukraine in the position of being able to claim that it's ticking off all of the boxes of Minsk II. Right. That may have been a bad move on the part of the U.S. On the other hand, As with so many things in Ukraine, the immediate response to this was one of outrage. My own sense is that sense of outrage lasted approximately 3 hours. Since then, it's been forgotten by so many other things.
I mean, it also happened in a larger context that a lot of people have pointed out. John Kerry's trip to Sochi in May. After that, immediately the forming of the U.S.-Russia diplomatic channel on Ukraine, the one between Victoria Nuland and Deputy Russian Foreign Minister Grigory Karasin. And this had this kind of feeling of what the Czechs, when they speak about Munich, say, o nas, bez nas. You know, they had that kind of a feeling, the Americans and the Russians bilaterally deciding on Ukrainians' future. That was followed by Nuland's trip to Kyiv on the 16th. This all coming just as the Iran deal was reached. President Obama's comments about, praising Putin's ability to compartmentalize the Iran issue away from the other issues. So this all happened in a much broader context that caused people to be nervous. Steve, what are your thoughts? I mean, this didn't happen in isolation. I agree with you. There probably wasn't any kind of quid pro quo here, but just bad optics or something else?
No, I think people are looking at several different events that occurred in roughly the same time frame and looping them together in a way that, doesn't actually reflect the reality. Secretary Kerry, did go, met with Putin in Sochi. And I think part of that was a desire to keep, a line of communication open to Putin. But when you talk to U.S. officials before he went, the expectations for something coming out of that discussion were very low. And when you talk to people afterwards, those low expectations, in fact, were reflected the reality. Mm-hmm. I think it is not bad that you have the channel set up between Assistant Secretary Nuland and Deputy Foreign Minister Karasin for a conversation here. At least so far from what I've observed, it looks like Assistant Secretary Nuland has been very careful to avoid any kind of, we're negotiating over the heads of the Ukrainians. I mean, it seems to me that she, before she has a meeting or she travels to Moscow, she either stops in Kyiv or she has a phone call with senior Ukrainian officials. So it looks to me like she's making every effort to talk to the Ukrainians, make sure they understand what she's going to be going to Moscow to say, and then giving them a readout afterwards. So from that sense, I think that this is potentially, it may be a useful channel. And I say potentially, it's a useful channel if and when we get to a point where there's a change in Moscow and Russia begins to look for a serious settlement, a serious resolution of this. And by serious, something, not like they've suggested to date, but something that actually would have a prospect of some negotiability with the government in Kyiv. And again, the last point I'd make is that despite all the channels, you've seen no weakening on American sanctions policy. In fact, yesterday, the Treasury Department announced some additional sanctions targeted Russians, in large part to close off some of the escape routes. Certain targeted individuals were using family members or friends, and now those family members and friends have come under sanction. I think what you've seen here when people sort of tie the Sochi visit and Iran and Nuland Karasin, I think they're pulling things together in a way that probably does not reflect the reality.
And I'm glad, Steve, that you brought up the sanctions, because that does underscore that the U.S. policy really, really hasn't changed all that much here. Part of me thinks the U.S. is pulling the U.S. and the Ukrainians might be pulling a big dramaturgia on the Russians. I mean, the Russians are brilliant at creating these fake situations for drama purposes, to create the impression something's going on that's not. I don't think that's the way the U.S. operates, but looking at this, I haven't ruled it out. Alexander, what do you think?
Oh, I think that's perfectly possible. Part of me says that's a little too clever by half. On the other hand, it fits in very nicely with our former thesis that a lot of the activity regarding special status and things of that sort has to do with the approaching end of 2015 and the review of the Minsk Accords. And in that sense, it makes sense for the West and Ukraine to be doing everything possible to both fulfill the political requirements of Minsk and, perhaps more importantly, to create the impression that Ukraine is fulfilling the political requirements of Minsk. I mean, certainly both of those are equally important in this kind of diplomatic game, and Russia understands that. I just wanted to add one more point. You know, when we talk about possible shifts in all these conspiracy theories, while all this is taking place, United States soldiers are training Ukrainian soldiers in Western Ukraine. And that, I think, is something that we should keep in mind as being extremely important. I mean, this is, I mean, it's not exactly the equivalent of providing lethal weaponry, but it's just one step short of that. And if anything is a commitment of, if anything reflects a commitment of America to the to Ukraine, it's precisely that.
Well, along those lines, yeah, it does illustrate that the seriousness of the affair. And I wanted to go back to Ambassador Pyatt to listen to one more clip from him to touch off the last segment of our discussion.
I would just underline the stakes for what's happening. Our principles and shared transatlantic values are at stake in the conflict underway today in Ukraine. The cardinal principle of respect for international borders and territorial integrity has been jeopardized. Ukraine is the front line of freedom in Europe. Our policies and efforts have been successful over the past year and a half because we have stayed united in our efforts and coordinated in our analysis.
Ukraine is the front lines of freedom in Europe. I mean, that's something that used to be said about West Berlin, if I remember from my younger days. Does the West have a sense of what is at stake in Ukraine, really? I mean, is there a sense of urgency, or has this issue taken on a secondary importance to things like Syria and Iran? Steve, what do you think? I mean, this, when we're looking at it from here and from folks like us that focus on these things for a living, it has this huge sense of urgency. But in the broader policy community, is there a sense of urgency about this to the extent that there is about Iran and Syria and Islamic State and other issues that are on the table?
Yeah, no, there is a sense of urgency about Ukraine. I mean, and going back to what Ambassador Pyatt said, tomorrow, August 1, is the 40th anniversary of the Helsinki Final Act. And among other things in that act, at the insistence of the Soviet Union, was this strong recognition of the inviolability of borders, of territorial integrity, of national sovereignty. And I would say the cardinal principle of the Helsinki European Security Order for the last 40 years has been you don't use military force to change borders or to take territory. And Russia has blatantly violated that. So that does provide a sense that there's something very, very important here. My sense is that for Chancellor Merkel, this is the really important driver. It's this point of principle, which has caused her, among other things, to basically tell the German business community, I understand your business interests with Russia, but the sanctions are important for higher principles. Now, the problem that Ukraine has, even though it's an urgent issue, is that if you look at both Washington and European capitals, it's competing with lots of other questions. So in Washington, it's Iran, and the White House focus now is on making sure that Congress does not undo the P5 plus one deal with Iran that was concluded earlier in July. It's how do you deal with ISIS? There's the bigger question of China out there. So it's competing with a lot of things. In Europe, it's competing with stagnant economies. It's competing with the crisis of the Greek exit and things like that. And one can hope, you know, maybe in a month or two after Iran is behind Washington, if there's a little bit more time behind Greece, you know, hopefully the West can come back and provide more focus. Now, this doesn't mean attention's not being paid, but when you get to the sort of the top level, when you're talking about, you know, President Obama, Chancellor Merkel, Prime Minister Cameron, for those guys, and in the case of Chancellor Merkel, for that woman, there's only so many hours in the day. And that's the problem that Ukraine has. It's competing with a lot of other very urgent problems.
Alexander, what do you think? Is the sense of urgency there? Is it? I mean, I think Steve pretty much hit it on the head. I think that's where we're at. Is Ukraine getting enough attention? Is this issue getting enough attention, given its importance, given what's at stake?
Well, I mean, obviously, if you ask the Ukrainians, the answer will always be no. And arguably, objectively, one might say perhaps not quite as much as it should. On the other hand, Steve's absolutely right. I mean, there's only so many things that one can do. There are so many other strategic issues. I think the important thing, however, to keep in mind is this, is that for the first time since Ukraine's independence, which is to say for the first time ever, Ukraine has finally become something like a strategic issue and indeed something like a strategic asset of the West. It never was that. That role was always confined, appropriately so, given its status, to Russia. Russia was either the problem, the threat, and certainly since 1991, let's say through the mid-2000s, it was perceived as a potential strategic asset. Ukraine was always in the shadows. Our relationship with Ukraine was always a function of our relationship with Russia. When relations with Russia were good, Ukraine didn't matter. When relations with Russia soured, Ukraine suddenly began to matter. The difference now is that Putin, thanks to his own reckless behavior, his imperialism, war, and everything else, has transformed Russia into something resembling a more or less permanent, or at least a possibly permanent, strategic issue, strategic threat for the West. That was not the case for the last 25 years. It is the case, and my guess is it is likely to remain the case as long as Putin continues to occupy Crimea, continues to occupy the Donbass, continues to rattle sabers all along the borders with Finland, Estonia, Belarus, and other places as well. That means that Ukraine has finally been transformed into something it's never been, a strategic asset. And I think that's the way one can interpret this business of its being on the front lines of freedom. It is. It's on the front lines either of freedom, of geopolitics, call it what you like, but is finally on the front lines, and people in the West understand that. Now, that said, as Steve points out, there are other front lines as well. Mm-hmm. The world is a complex and messy place, and Ukraine will have to compete for countries' attention. However, again, I emphasize, in the last 25 years, Ukraine was at best of tactical interest. And for it to compete for attention was extremely difficult because it was basically a non-issue. Now it's an issue, it's an asset. And for it to be able to acquire that attention will be significantly easier for the foreseeable future.
Well, that gives us a great way for me to segue out on an optimistic note, because, I mean, when the debate about Ukraine and integrating Ukraine into the West, whether it be the EU, NATO, what have you, has always been seen, I don't want to use the term charity case, but it's also always been seen as kind of an altruistic move. Like, we're doing this for the Ukrainians. But let's flip this around, Alex, because I think you make a really good point here, is that transforming Ukraine into a strategic asset, and the operative and key word there is asset, implies that there is something for the West to gain as well in having Ukraine turn this corner and become a full-fledged member of the West. I mean, Ukraine in this sense is West Germany or Poland at some point, at a later stage in history. What are I want to throw this to both of you before, as the last word before we sign out. What are the gains of bringing Ukraine full fold into the West if this ends up being Putin's greatest legacy?
Well, imagine that Ukraine is stable, secure, relatively prosperous, and doing all the right things economically and so on. And my own sense is that that's exactly where Ukraine is going. So imagine that kind of Ukraine. Again, Ukraine as a Poland and not Ukraine as a Zimbabwe, in other words. Well, that kind of Ukraine automatically contributes to Europe's security, automatically contributes to Europe's stability, automatically contributes to Europe's prosperity, economic growth, and the rest, as well as, of course, by extension, to the stability, security, and prosperity of the West in general, as well as the United States. I mean, somewhat removed, but obviously in that regard as well. That kind of Ukraine is also a stabilizing factor in Eurasia, in as much as it would be able to either contain Russia or act as a partner for Russia, as a genuine partner for Russia, as opposed to a vassal state kind of partner for Russia. It seems to me that Ukraine's strength would be a win-win, obviously, for Ukraine, but also for the West.
Steve?
Yeah, I share that view. I mean, a Ukraine that is stable, democratic, with a growing economy is very much in the interest of the West. And I hope Ukraine moves in that direction. I think that they've taken some initial steps on reform, but they have a lot to do, and it's not going to be easy, even setting aside the challenge that you have in eastern Ukraine. I mean, there are fundamental economic, political, and anti-corruption reforms that still need to be going on. And that's the kind of Ukraine, you know, if it moves in that direction, if it begins to look more like Poland, that's what the West wants on its border, as opposed to a stable as opposed to an unstable, economically weak state. And if Ukraine succeeds, that, in fact, I think helps make its case ultimately for where it would like to go, membership in the European Union. You know, my guess is NATO's still going to have certain sensitivities, but even that kind of Ukraine, it will bolster its case if it wants to go forward to NATO. The problem is that kind of Ukraine is the Kremlin's worst nightmare, because if you look at what has been driving Vladimir Putin's policy towards Ukraine over the last 18 months, I believe it's first and foremost domestic concerns. And that domestic concern is, if the government that came out of the Maidan revolution succeeds in Ukraine, builds a Ukraine that looks like Poland, that's stable, democratic, and economically prosperous, that then becomes a model for Russians. And I think the Kremlin has this very paranoid fear about it. And that's the additional challenge that Ukraine faces, is can it do all the things that it needs to do internally to get on a course that makes it look like another Poland, and still be able to fend off the pressures that are likely to come from Russia to try to derail that project.
Well, this is where it needs, it of course needs the West's help in this regard. I mean, exactly. The Ukraine could hardly stand up to Russia all on its own, but if it's able to stand up to Russia with the West's help, it becomes not a charity case for the West, but an asset. I mean, I think, Alex, you hit it on the head there. I think a strategic asset is a way that we probably should be thinking about Ukraine. Well, on that note, I guess we'll wrap it up for today. That's all we have time for. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City has been Alexander Motyl, a professor at Rutgers University Newark and author of numerous books on post-Soviet affairs. And joining us from Washington, D.C. has been Stephen Pfeiffer, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and the former United States ambassador to Ukraine. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
And I'd also like to thank our producer, Jan Kaiser, who is ably filling in for Tanya Koncheva, who is enjoying a much-needed and much-deserved vacation. I'd also like to thank my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable and totally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Bruce Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rap star, Noise MC.